A corporate lawyer stands in her Upper East Side apartment at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, pouring expensive Bordeaux for herself and three concerned friends. She's wearing designer clothes, her resume gleams with prestigious firms, and from the outside, her life looks enviable. But inside, she's dying. For 15 years, she's hidden vodka bottles in her handbag, snorted cocaine between client meetings, and perfected the art of looking put together while completely falling apart. This is the paradox of high-functioning addiction, a life that appears successful while secretly unraveling. What makes one person finally reach for help after years of denial? Sometimes there's no dramatic catalyst, no rock-bottom moment. Sometimes you just wake up and realize you can't do it anymore. That Monday morning, Lisa made calls she'd rehearsed but never thought she'd actually make. Jerry arrived first, suit rumpled from rushing over. Russell and Devin followed, three fellow lawyers taking time from demanding careers to help a friend in crisis. The scene was absurdly civilized, four successful professionals drinking wine before 10 a.m. while discussing rehab facilities like vacation destinations. Lisa's mind raced with social anxieties. Would she still get invited to dinner parties? Could she survive work events sober? When the time came to leave, panic set in. She invented excuses about client deadlines and urgent meetings. But Devin, who'd known her for 20 years, cut through the denial. You won't survive another year like this. At Gracie Square Hospital, the stark institutional walls felt worlds away from her usual upscale haunts. Brad explained this was a locked psychiatric ward requiring minimum 72-hour commitment, no privacy, mandatory group activities. As Devin left, Lisa signed the papers with trembling hands, acutely aware her carefully constructed facade had just shattered. Long before her first drink, 8-year-old Lisa learned to soothe emotional pain with external comfort. After being laughed at during a summer camp canoe demonstration, she asked her mother for double her normal ice cream portion. While peers casually enjoyed treats, Lisa developed secretive behaviors, sneaking extra portions, hiding candy under her mattress, hoarding snacks in her backpack. Food became her private solution to every emotional challenge. A pediatrician's harsh assessment: if you don't stop eating, you're going to be as big as a house, burned shame into her psyche. Her mother's response, taking Lisa to Burger King for comfort, inadvertently reinforced the pattern. Her after-school routine became ritualistic, watching TV with multiple bowls of ice cream, finding those 90 minutes the closest I ever came to happy. Meanwhile, her parents' sophisticated cocktail culture normalized alcohol as a social lubricant. By age 8, she was secretly sipping abandoned drinks. By 10, deliberately catching buzzes. By 12, drinking to silence the trash-talking mosquito of self-doubt. By 15, binge drinking and experimenting with cocaine. Despite perfect grades and acceptance to Northwestern University, by 18, she was a blackout drunk who couldn't control her consumption. Lisa's story defies stereotypes. She was a successful corporate lawyer, not unemployed or homeless. After transferring to corporate finance, her anxiety soared despite professional success. Business trips established a dangerous pattern: exhausting document reviews by day, solitary drinking in hotel rooms at night. In Florida, she was shocked to discover she'd consumed 12 beers poolside in one afternoon. Her nightly wine binges felt shameful, unlike her parents' ritualistic cocktail hour that fostered connection. By 2003, cocaine joined her morning routine. The stimulant masked her drinking. She just looked happy. "You're always smiling," colleagues said, never knowing the truth. She'd stopped contributing to her 401k, expecting to be dead by 40. When her brother's first child was born, she stayed home doing lines instead. Most alarming was leaving cocaine in an open cigarette pack on her office desk, a potentially career-ending mistake. Finding it untouched after a partner meeting, she collapsed with relief, but couldn't escape what she'd become. When Lisa confessed, "I think I'm an alcoholic," at a Tribeca party, her friends dismissed it. David argued she'd be messing up at work if true. Jessica called her just a heavy drinker. Though she had evidence, Lisa let them talk her out of it, deepening her isolation. Her marriage to Alan was an escape attempt. 3 months into Pittsburgh life, she was drinking at noon on Saturdays, hiding bottles behind cleaning supplies. While cooking, she'd secretly gulp wine before serving Alan. As they ate, watching TV, she'd think, "Be happy. Look how lucky you are." Then slip away to do dishes and refill her glass. Later, she met Mark, a student 10 years younger from her building. Despite her disheveled appearance, mascara-smeared eyes, bloated face, tangled hair, he seemed comfortable with her chaos. When he suggested rehab, she exploded and threw him out. Yet he would become crucial support during early recovery. The profound loneliness permeated everything. She felt like she was alone in a little boat floating far out on open water, the people on shore getting smaller and smaller. Lisa's 3 days in detox marked her first consecutive days with alcohol since college. Standing in line for chest x-rays, she thought the patients in heavy lead aprons looked like a team of exhausted, wrecked knights waiting for a match. Nurse Jane prescribed Librium for withdrawal and Lexapro for depression, allowing her first alcohol-free sleep in 10 years. Dr. Landry explained alcoholism as a disease involving brain chemistry, often tied to depression. When he suggested she might never drink again, requiring medication and a 12-step program, Lisa was devastated. Though she nodded agreement, inside she was screaming for vodka. By Friday, Dr. Landry expressed disappointment she'd refused extended treatment, emphasizing that staying sober would be the most difficult thing you've ever done. As she left, she felt vulnerable, no longer the confident corporate lawyer, but fragile, with her bar stool at Kenny's already tempting her. Despite advice to rest, Lisa returned to work immediately. Her walk home became a gauntlet. Passing Pete's Tavern, she saw patrons like an aquarium of exotic fish gliding past each other. The unbearable truth: many people could have a drink or two and stop, an ability she wasn't born with. After weeks of feeling fantastic, the terror of relapse set in. She was riding a pink cloud, the happy glow newly clean addicts experience. But what happens when the novelty wears off? Her friend Calvin warned that once you acknowledge this stuff is killing you yet still go back to it, the joy of using is gone forever. 12 years into sobriety, Lisa had made amends, married a wonderful man in Santa Fe, and was present for her father's death. The recovery community sustained her. She called sober friends who helped her stay clean, and she helped others salvage their lives. She became a present aunt who showed up for sleepovers. For more than 4,000 mornings, she awakened and made the same decision: just for today, I will not drink. That's not just survival, that's building a life worth protecting, one morning at a time.